Hi, everyone, and welcome to our little press release today. We wanted to do something like this because Children's Health Defense Canada has been inundated with messages and phone calls from very concerned parents and students who are being coerced to exchange their private medical records in exchange for access to their right to post-secondary education. Children's Health Defense is working with two incredible Canadian lawyers to challenge these egregious rights violations of our healthy young adults. It is my great pleasure today to welcome Rocco Gulati, the top Canadian constitutional lawyer, as well as the executive director and founder of the Constitutional Rights Center, as well Amina Shirazi, an accomplished and talented human rights legal expert and operational director of the Constitutional Rights Center. And might I add, a woman with a complete heart of gold. So thank you both so much for being here today. I'm just going to hand it over. The floor is yours. Welcome.
Thank you, Christy. Children's Health Defense has written to Western University and to Seneca College, and they've demanded the immediate withdrawal of their so-called mandatory vaccination policies. The not-for-profit organization has been inundated with calls from concerned parents and students who enroll in universities and colleges to seek post-secondary education, but instead are being forced and coerced into experimental medical treatment. Health Canada has not approved the so-called COVID-19 vaccination for general use. What is only permitted is on the basis of emergency use authorization. Hence, we call these shots EUA, inoculations, and is a treatment that has not been clinically tested or proven to prevent either the risk of infection or the risk of transmission of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Enough scientific and medical evidence is available for the university and colleges to know that the EUA inoculations are not effective against infection or transmission, not necessary for the post-secondary student age population, subject to safety and recall alerts, including by Health Canada itself, causing significant adverse effects and risk, including fatalities, and for all these reasons is not being mandated by either any level of government or any health agency, including public health. Therefore, the universities and colleges know or ought to know that the so-called vaccines are hazardous. In effect, then, what these institutions of higher learning are doing is therefore illegal and unconscionable. It is contrary to Ontario's laws with respect to medical care and consent, and with respect to the protection of personal health and private information. And moreover, it is contrary to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The universities and colleges policy on forced medical treatment and forced disclosure of protected private information therefore undermines medical choice and informed consent, and it makes an arbitrary and unlawful distinction between students based on private medical and health data and status that is discriminatory. It is unjustifiable, as all medical evidence, regardless of the source, including from public health, confirms that the risk reduction is negligible. The CRC is defending the rights of students to be able to access and exercise their right to education without being forced into relinquishing their legal and constitutional rights. For this, we require your support. Please go to our website and read the full letters and donate to the Children's Health Defense Canada cases. Thank you for your support in defending our constitutional rights.
Now everyone knows why I let her do most of the talking. I'm just going to be brief and say that the Constitutional Rights Center has put Western and Seneca College on notice. We intend to put all other institutions who are doing the same thing on notice. And if they fail to cease and desist, our center will procure legal counsel to take them to court. something that people should understand and think about. The common law statute and the Constitution guarantees you, as a constitutional right, your right to refuse any and all medical treatment without your informed voluntary consent. The universities don't seem to care about the Constitution or the law. They often hide behind the transparent fig leaf that they are a private university who have a contractual obligation with their students. Well, they do that too, but they also have a fiduciary duty. And under contract law, if a clause or term or condition is unconscionable, the courts will void it for public policy as unconscionable. Well, if anything is otherwise unconstitutional, for a university to demand it is certainly unconscionable because it breaches the principles and rights set out in the supreme law of the land. So the other thing that people should understand is, what if we put the shoe on the other foot? What if people who exercise their constitutional right and are not vaccinated say, well, if you're doing this under the pretext of protecting the rest of the student population on COVID, even though there's no scientific or medical basis for that, well, then I would want every student's, professors, and university staff medical history and detail known to me, so I can avoid those who are HIV or STD positive or who have other disorders and diseases that might pose a health risk to me. Do you think that would wash? I don't think so, and it shouldn't. So why should it wash for the select significant sector of the population who has chosen to exercise their constitutional right not to take the COVID-19 medically experimental inoculation? Thank you.
Thank you, Amina and Rocco. That was great. Our next speaker is Hannah Salomon Bay. She is a fourth-year student at the University of Western Ontario. She's very active and knowledgeable in women's rights and children's rights, as well as human rights. Thank you so much for being here, Hannah. The floor is all yours.
Yeah, thank you so much, everyone, for this opportunity to speak here today. I just want to mention a few things from the perspective of a student, because there's a perspective of lawyers here and professors and doctors and all that, and we are all so important in this battle for protecting our constitutional rights. But as a student, this is something that's been a concern to me for a while, especially with the masks being mandated last year and then now the vaccines in residence. And all these things are testing the waters to see how much people will be willing to put up with. And it's a very gradual thing. I understand the lockdowns happened last year very, overnight. We had lockdowns and that was it. But so many of these other things are very gradual and wearing people down, and seeing if they're going to be willing to give up this and then this and then this, you know, and the promise of being able to have education and a promise of being able to go back to normal life. And unfortunately, we see that they move the goalposts every single time, and it's incredibly abusive. And so it's interesting to see at my university the amount of people, professors and students, who used to say that education is a right, and that even that living in residence is a right, and now they're suddenly changing their tune, and they're like, oh no, living in residence and having education, all those things are not human rights, but learning and living in a safe environment, that's a human right. So we're seeing that they change what they say depending on what they want and how much they want to control other people. And unfortunately, some of my students that I've talked to on campus have no understanding of human rights. They do not understand the Charter. They do not understand the Constitution. And they just believe all this media propaganda. They're petrified. You can tell them all the amount of statistics and data and everything like that. They don't have to be worried that if they get the vaccine, if it actually works, they don't have to worry about anybody else. And unfortunately, many of these people, no matter how much you reason with them, it does not help. I try as best as possible to talk with these students and go on different shows and that type of thing to get the word out. But for many people right now, legality and the threat of lawsuits is the only thing that matters. And it's very interesting because last Saturday, I was walking on campus at Western and I happened to bump into Alan Shepard, who's the president of Western. And I decided to approach him and introduce myself that I'm a student on campus. I had seen him around many times. He's quite a figure on campus. I know where his office is, all that. So we get to see him around quite a lot. So I introduced myself to him and I asked him that I was concerned that Western might be mandating the vaccine across campus. And I asked him point blank, would Western be doing that? And his response to me is that Western would not be doing that because they did not want the risk of lawsuits. And he said that in his own words that Seneca College was opening themselves up to lawsuits and legal action. And he said that unfortunately our country is not set up to allow for mandatory vaccines. So, and then he went on to ask me if my husband and I had been vaccinated, and I told him that was our private medical information. So then he chilled off after that. But so, you know, for a little bit I was like, okay, I have like 1% hope that he's actually meaning what he says, because there's so much lobbying going on. The Faculty Association at Western, which is the basically the union for faculty, they're now lobbying and trying to get Western to mandate the vaccine. And, you know, the mayor of London, he's on the board of directors at Western, and he has been so pro, you know, mask, pro lockdown, pro vaccine and all that type of thing. So basically it's going to be a battle of lobbying and it's going to be a battle of lawsuits. And so I'm just very thankful for what the Constitutional Rights Center is doing, Children's Health Defense, all these, you know, the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms, all these other people, because we're living in very precarious times. And I personally have quite a few friends at Western that are extremely concerned about the vaccine being mandated, and they don't know what they're going to do. So I also know students from other campuses as well, and this is something that's front and center on our minds. And I can personally attest that when I tried to have accommodations not to wear a mask for medical reasons last year, any of Western's virtue signaling on paper that there would be accommodations, that type of thing, none of it played out in real life. And the only option was for you to wear a face shield, and then you would be treated like a second class citizen and not be allowed to go on campus freely like anybody else. So I suspect the same thing will be the case. If they mandate the vaccine, they may offer accommodations, but will still be treated like second class citizens, anyone who does not want to get the vaccine. So some people are like, oh, well, you know, if they mandate it, that's okay, because there'll be exemptions. Those exemptions are ridiculously hard to get. And so often we're treated like second class citizens, and it's just not proper for human rights, for dignity, all that type of thing. So I would just say that this is a very important topic. And even if people are listening here and they're pro-vaccine, that's totally fine, but you should be pro-voluntary informed consent. Anyone can have a vaccine if they want. That's their total free choice. However, these types of things should not be forced into people against their own will, and we should not be told that if you don't get this vaccine or the next vaccine or whatever, that you'll not be allowed to live and exist as a normal human being, because right now it's the COVID vaccine. In the future, it'll be other things, and it's just setting a very dangerous precedent for our future as Canadians. So this is something that's incredibly important, and I'm just thankful for the opportunity to speak here, because it's something I'm extremely passionate about. As Julie has said, this is the hill we will die on. And if you're not willing to die on any hill, and if you keep saying this is not the hill to die on, you will never die on any hill. And unfortunately, you'll just be a pawn for a state that's getting stronger and stronger, and for, you know, unfortunately, many universities and colleges who don't respect human rights anymore. So I'm thankful for the work that everyone is doing and for the opportunity to speak here today and just share a bit about my perspective as a student. So thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Hannah, you are clearly a force for light, and I can't thank you enough for being here and joining us today. So thank you. Thank you very much. Our next speaker, Dr. Michael Palmer, is a chemistry professor at the University of Waterloo who has been very outspoken about his concerns since the start of the COVID restrictions here in Ontario, especially regarding university students. So welcome, Dr. Palmer, and thank you so much for joining us. And again, the floor is all yours.
Okay, thank you very much. I would actually like to share some screens. Share my screen, sorry. And here we go. Okay, I hope they can be seen. So just very briefly.
Hold on about myself. 1 second, we'll get you up here. It's not coming up yet. Here we go. All right, okay, you're good.
Very good, thank you. Okay, so just very briefly about myself. I teach biochemistry in a chemistry department, but my training is in medicine. So I'm an MD from Germany, And I also have a board certification from Germany in medical microbiology, so I know one thing or two about viruses and so on. Okay, also, I'm speaking here for myself. I don't speak on behalf of my institution, sadly, because I wish it were otherwise. Okay, so let's get right into it, right? Brief background. What do we mean by immunization, right? In traditional medicine, or in actually proper medicine, it obviously means that a vaccinated person is protected from the disease in question, regardless of how many unvaccinated people might surround them, okay? We have vaccines that do show this behavior, smallpox, measles, German measles, poliomyelitis. All of these vaccines work, and we don't mandate them because those who want them can protect themselves. Those who don't want them, they can make a choice without endangering anyone of those who have gotten the vaccination. Okay, so what valid reasons could there be to mandate vaccines? I propose I won't read all of these reasons to you. But one important point is, right now, the argument is we need it for herd immunity. We need to protect everybody by vaccinating everybody. Or we need to protect those who might not be able to protect it by immunizing the rest of us. But as Amina already pointed out, the COVID vaccines have never been shown to prevent transmission. They don't prevent transmission of the disease. So even if you are vaccinated, you can still acquire and transmit the virus, which means herd immunity is not achievable with these vaccines. So this is not a viable reason for mandating the COVID vaccines. Okay, now another question is, do we even need the vaccine? And that boils down to the question, how dangerous is the virus? In the overall population, the case fatality rate of COVID-19 is on the order of 0.1 to 0.5%, and that is very similar to regular influenza. We have never locked down society just because another flu wave struck. Okay, so if we didn't shut down then, we don't need to shut down now. Okay, now on top of this, right, as everybody knows by now, it is almost exclusively the ones with a pre-existing disease and the frail and elderly who are at danger to die of this virus or to become gravely ill. Okay, so this means that young people without comorbidity, the typical university students, they are at an extremely low risk of severe death or death from disease or death from the virus. There absolutely is no reason to vaccinate these people because the danger due to the disease is minimal. Then how effective are these vaccines? The key point is all these clinical trials have been based on specious evaluation criteria, right? The dividing line between a case and a non-case was a positive PCR test, usually with unspecified sensitivity of that test, and one or more non-specific symptoms from a laundry list of symptoms of respiratory disease. That is not relevant. There was no basis, simply because there were too few cases of severe disease in those tests, too few cases of death. It could not be demonstrated that there is any effectiveness against severe disease or fatality. Okay, we have lately seen data from Israel. Israel has been largely vaccinated, mostly with the Pfizer mRNA vaccine. There is no difference in the vaccinated and unvaccinated in the likelihood to be admitted to hospital with COVID. These vaccines don't work. Okay, there is no credible evidence at all that these vaccines have any effect on the likelihood of contracting severe COVID disease. Okay, now how safe are the COVID vaccines? I just looked up the most recent news from American frontline doctors who have been very brave in digging up the truth and filing lawsuits about it. And they have an affidavit that claims close to 55,000 vaccine-related deaths in the United States alone. That is far higher than was previously known from the VAERS system, which is still below 10,000 in the total count, but trending up strongly, okay? If you transfer this to Canada with about 10% of the population, you would have to assume that we have at least 5,500 deaths in Canada. But the official numbers in Canada are still below 200. Okay, so this means we have grave, very grave distortion, very grave underreporting, particularly in Canada. We have it in all countries, but Canada seems to have a particularly bad case of underreporting. Okay. Now, the clinical tests and the authorization processes were completely flawed and farcical, way too short. And I looked at those documents myself, FDA, Health Canada, the European agency, they never followed up on any grave concerns. They just waved it all through. These authorizations, they are based on a deeply flawed vetting process. Even if full approval should be granted now, it is a complete farce. It is absolutely scientifically untenable. The entire basis on which these authorizations rest is completely scientifically untenable. Another point is that due to the specific workings of the mRNA vaccines, not going to go into detail here, but here we have to expect that repeated vaccinations will cause cumulative damage. Okay, with the conventional vaccines, that would be unlikely. You get your shot once, you get your vaccine reactions once, or maybe twice, but then that's it, then the damage is done. With the mRNA vaccines, which are now passed off as the safe choice, this is not the case. We have to expect that the damage will be at least as, the risk will at least be at least as high with every successive vaccination as it was with the previous ones. Okay. An additional detail also, if we simply add up the numbers that are in the US VAERS system, the COVID vaccines, right, the total deaths and the adverse events exceed for the few months that these vaccines have been in use, they exceed the totals for the 30-year period, right, for all other vaccines combined. That includes the flu vaccine, which also is very widely administered, which shows, right, in a nutshell, the COVID vaccines are by far the most harmful vaccines ever to have been tried on humans. Okay, now adverse reactions in young people. Okay, one mitigating factor is, with, as with any other harmful influence, as with any other disease, young people stand up better to it than old people. So not quite so many young people are being killed by these injections, as is the case with the older people. But indeed, we have multiple reports of deaths in young people in the United States, in the UK, in the European Union, everywhere. Okay, the incidence is not quite so high as with the elderly, but some young people have been killed. And on top of that, the adverse events, non-fatal adverse events, are actually similarly frequent in the young as they are in the old. Okay, so even if the young people don't get killed, they still have a very high likelihood to suffer significant disease, for example, myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart muscle, seizures, which point to brain damage, and the brain damage in many cases appears most likely permanent. Okay, and if we add it all up, if we factor in the repeated vaccinations with the cumulative risk, if we factor in the size of the student populations on the Canadian campuses, we have to conclude that severe and irreversible disease and even death are very highly likely to occur as a direct consequence of the vaccine mandates being instituted by the campuses now. This is the harsh truth. We have to expect irreversible damage, brain damage, other functional damage, and even death as a consequence of these vaccine mandates. That is my considered opinion as an MD. Okay, so my conclusion to this, since the COVID vaccines don't prevent transmission, you will not be protecting anybody else by getting vaccinated. There is no upside, there's only downside to this vaccination. You are not going to do your share or do your part, as the Ontario government likes to propagandize now. You are not going to do your part, or you're only going to do your part by putting extra load on the healthcare system by becoming a vaccine victim. That's all. You are not helping anybody. You are only putting yourself, your own health, your own life at risk. And there's no benefit to it. Okay. So here's a website at which you can find some more information should you seek it, but this is enough for me now. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Wow, that's, there's just no words. I don't even have any words for the Twilight Zone anymore, but thank you for joining us. And we will post those slides on our website at childrenshealthdefense.ca. So for those of you that want to find them, you can go over.
Yes, great, thank you.
Wonderful. Our next speaker is Dr. Julie Panessi. She's an ethics professor at the University of Western Ontario with a background in bioethics. Dr. Panessi has some serious ethical concerns with the current COVID situation, and I will let her explain more. Welcome, Dr. Panessi, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Amanda. Thank you so much. I'd like to start by reading a policy brief from the World Health Organization that was published on April 13th of this year. And it reads, given the lack of data on the safety and efficacy of COVID-19 vaccines for children, vaccination is not currently ethically justified as a condition for attending school. In some jurisdictions, vaccination against the viruses that cause a number of diseases, such as polio, measles, mumps, and rubella, is a condition for attending school or receiving state-sponsored entitlements. However, mandates for routine pediatric vaccines are distinct from vaccines authorized for emergency use in many respects, including the relatively limited and evolving evidence for COVID-19 vaccines, in addition to uncertainty regarding herd immunity and new SARS-CoV-2 variants. Deciding whether or not to mandate an investigational vaccine for children depends on a very careful risk analysis, especially with regard to safety and efficacy. When it comes to minors, many of the factors are just simply unknown. What we do know is that COVID poses a minuscule risk of severe illness and death to them. In Canada and the UK, those under 18 with COVID have a 99.995% chance of surviving, and at least five times that number have died from drowning in the sea. Risk to children from seasonal influenza associated with more severe illness than COVID. Children are also not asymptomatic transmitters, so arguments about vaccinating them in order to protect others is scientifically and ethically unsound. There are safe treatments, including ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, which are available, and this alone means that the COVID shots shouldn't have been authorized under interim order in the first place. Vaccines, the COVID vaccines are investigational. They're still in their trial stage. Pfizer's study, for example, included a very small number of children followed for 1 or 2 months, and we just simply have no long-term data on the safety and efficacy. The extremely low risk of COVID to youth is coupled with very concerning adverse effects, as Michael has just explained. And now we have research to show that the spike protein travels extensively throughout the body to the brain and other sensitive tissues, including bone marrow, the spleen, liver, adrenal glands, and possibly the ovaries. Even if the side effects were rare, the benefits a vaccine may offer to adolescents and the wider community is so vanishingly small, it is not worth even a minor risk of vaccine injury. And this imposes a weighty ethical obligation on us to respond very carefully and very proportionately. There are, I think, three important ethical considerations when it comes to mandating COVID shots for university students. First of all, a basic ethical concept in public health is that of disproportionate harms. And the idea there is that the treatment should not pose harms that are equal to or greater than what it is supposed to treat. Mandatory vaccination should be considered only if it is necessary and proportionate to achieve an unequivocal public health benefit such as herd immunity. And the World Health Organization tells us that if this can't be shown, the goal should be achieved by other means, with less strict restrictions on liberty and autonomy and a more favorable risk-benefit ratio. The vaccines that are authorized for emergency or conditional use must therefore meet a very high evidentiary threshold. Mandating the COVID shots does not clearly meet that threshold. Therefore, it's not ethically justified, especially if it doesn't allow for reasonable exceptions such as medical contraindications. Secondly, it is crucial that we follow a precautionary principle. When it comes to minimally understood, serious and irreversible events like vaccine injury, and where the public's intervention, such as vaccination, is not shown to be necessary, we need to proceed with great caution. A poorly understood, better safe than sorry mentality will be costly to our most vulnerable members. Thirdly, vulnerability. Adolescents are a vulnerable population because of their inability fully and independently to protect their interests, especially in the context of inequalities of power between themselves and adults. In Canada, we have a sliding scale for competence that is usually determined on a case-by-case basis. Ontario's Healthcare Consent Act says that there is no minimum age to provide consent for vaccination, and the child does not need external permission if they are capable of understanding and appreciating the consequences of that decision. But for their decision to be fully informed, they must understand and be able to contextualize all the risks from COVID to them, which are minuscule, and from the shots, which are largely unknown, but the early data is very worrisome. This inability to give fully informed consent is compounded by a lack of robust discussion of the risks versus benefits of the COVID shots in public discourse. One thing that is particularly relevant when it comes to mandating vaccination for 17, 18, 19-year-olds is with the effect of the vaccines on infertility. And the value a person places on infertility changes over the course of a lifetime. When you're young and invincible and focused on other things, it doesn't hold very much value. But that may change once you're of childbearing years and your values shift to starting a family. Also, a reason for attending a post-secondary institution is to spread one's wings, to explore opportunities, to expand your horizons in a setting that respects freedom of choice and the development of one's own ideas. Now, the price of admission to many colleges and universities is the forfeiture of bodily autonomy and critical thinking. A coerced medical choice is standing between students and the education they work so hard to access. I'm also concerned about what message we're sending children and adolescents, telling them to do something merely because their government or institution tells them to, in the absence of compelling evidence, and make them feel guilty for asking questions and for demanding evidence in the first place. In sum, I think we're in a situation in which we are mandating an investigational treatment with very little trial data, especially in this age group, but with very worrisome and concerning adverse event data, to protect, supposedly, youth from a virus which poses to them a statistically insignificant risk. And you compound that with the fact that minors are being asked to give free, informed consent, something which is complicated enough for adults in this situation, and which requires a risk analysis based not only on general statistics, but on one's age, gender, and personal medical history. And the fact that this mandate threatens their right to education means that the university vaccination mandates are at best ethically unsupported and at worst gravely irresponsible. What we do to ensure that the physical and mental health of our young people is protected, that they have the best futures possible, and that we create the conditions to give them the greatest autonomy possible, is one of the biggest responsibilities of people who raise and educate them, and a mark of any great democratic nation. Our children are quite literally our future, and deserve our greatest care and attention. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. Does anyone have anything to add here before we sign off?
Yeah, if I may, Amanda, because it's also the verbiage has come up during the course of this podcast or whatever you want to call it, this release. I'm somewhat alarmed when people talk about exemptions with respect to policies like this, and I'll tell you why. What the university is doing is unlawful. It's illegal. And at the extremes, criminal, because medical experimentation without informed consent is a crime against humanity under the War Crimes and Crimes Against Humanity Act in Canada. It's a domestic criminal legislation. So to talk in pathologically depraved terms of seeking an exemption and proving that exemption to the persons who are acting illegally against you is really depraved. You have to think about that twice. You do not need an exemption from unlawful activity, illegal activity, criminal activity against you, okay? It's like saying a gang is gonna perform a bunch of break and enters in the neighborhood, but if you can prove to them you have an exemption, they won't break into your house. It's ludicrous. What these people are doing is illegal and criminal. So the fact that they hoodwink everybody into thinking they have the right to do this because they'll offer you an exemption if you qualify, okay, is pathological, depraved, and illegal. I just want people to think about that, to stop thinking about getting an exemption so that you can exercise your constitutional rights. That is ludicrous. That means the person telling you can get an exemption is putting themselves not only above the common law, statutory law, but above the supreme law of the country. These are renegade criminals to do that. So the word exemption should disappear from people's lexicon when it comes to these issues. You have the constitutional right to say, no, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for that. Does anybody else have anything to add?
Well, I just want to add to that. Yeah, that's 100% true. And also, like, I mean, everything about this is arbitrary, what they're doing. But even with the exemptions, they're super arbitrary, because even for residents at Western, they say, here's how you apply for an accommodation or an exemption. And then they approve them or disprove them case by case, right? So they could decide, oh, you know, we're going to have on paper that we have exemptions, but we're not actually going to offer them to anybody or allow anybody to have an exemption. And I mean, there's cases already right now, even in the U.S. With a girl at a university in Hawaii who has substantial reasons why she can't get the vaccine, and her university is like, nope, sorry, we're not going to offer you a medical exemption. And now, you know, she's having to fight that. But yeah, the first place, what they're doing is illegal. And then the fact that they're being extremely arbitrary with exemption is kind of like, oh, you know, this is a little carrot, but, you know, we'll just make people shut up basically with this little carrot, but this carrot doesn't actually mean anything. Like I said, with the mass exemptions that Western supposedly offered didn't mean anything. And they were violating the bylaw that we had in our local city, which said that, you know, there had to be exemptions. So on both accounts, it's completely wrong, but they're coercing so many people with it, which is very concerning. And it's putting so much stress on students, because a lot of students are just ending up getting the vaccine because they're like, I can't deal with this anymore, right? So that's the thing that is worrying on a lot of people.
Well, and the last thing I'd like to say, Amanda, is that in response to a personal information request of Health Canada, these criminal public officials have put nothing in place to track informed consent. They don't even care if anybody understands. They don't track it, they don't mandate it, they don't request it. That too is a criminal act in my view, my professional view as a lawyer, right? They should have a tracking system. They need to, if it were anything else, if you go to the hospital for any medical procedure, you're always asked to sign on the dotted line. But with these medically experimental inoculations, they're not even asking verbally.
Yeah, it's quite disturbing. Now, Julie, you mentioned that these vaccines are in the trial phase, and I mean, we all know that here, but people aren't understanding what this actually means. So Health Canada is saying that they're all approved, and then you get the people that are like, no, they're approved. Can somebody just explain in a little bit more detail, are these approved or are these not approved for people out there that are confused?
So the language in the States from the FDA is that they have received emergency use authorization. And in Canada, they have been authorized under an interim order. And I suspect that Michael would be better to address some of the scientific differences between those kinds of approvals and authorizations. But I think one thing that's really important for people to realize is that vaccine trials normally take a long time. Vaccines go through a long process of development, 5 to 10 years at minimum. And there's a very good reason for that. And that's because some deleterious effects, harmful effects are immediate. You know, we've seen that. We've seen some people who have anaphylactic responses, the myocarditis, but some effects take a lot longer to show up, years, decades even. One of the things I find particularly concerning is the position of Health Canada that the vaccines are perfectly safe for use in pregnant women and perfectly safe in terms of long-term effects on one's fertility. And given the duration of their production and the trials, we simply have not had enough time to be able to make that assessment.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Well, I want to thank everyone here today, Dr. Palmer, Hannah, Dr. Panessi, Christine, Rocco, Amina. Thank you so much for bringing a little bit of clarity to this. If you out there would like to help us, you can donate to the constitutionalrightscenter.ca under educational action, as well as childrenshealthdefense.ca. We're constantly trying to stay ahead of the curve and protect our kids. I mean, that's what it's about at the end of the day, savoring their freedom and taking on the burden so they don't have to at a later date. So thank you all so much for being here. I can't even tell you what it means to me. And thank you all for watching today. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you. We'll be right back.